Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast. Before we jump into today's episode, we've got a free resource you won't want to miss. It's called The Robot Race: Could AI Ever Replace Humanity? A thought-provoking ebook exploring the rise of artificial intelligence, what it means to be human, and how Christians can think biblically in this new tech age. If you've ever asked, can machines become conscious? Or does AI challenge our faith? This is for you. Download your free copy now at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Thank you for listening to the show that brings you the thought and theology of C.S. Lewis with me, Ruth Jackson. Discover more about Lewis by visiting premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, resources, and podcasts. And you can also register there for the chance to win a free book. If you enjoy listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it. But now for today's show.
I'm absolutely delighted to be joined today by Dr. Paul Anderson, a professor of biblical and Quaker studies at George Fox University in Oregon. He's the author of over 400 essays and the editor and author of over 30 books. And his new book that he's working on currently, Jesus in Johanan Perspective, Inviting a Fourth Quest for Jesus, will hopefully be out in 2026. So we're going to hear a little bit more about that. But Paul is also a founding member of the John Jesus and History Project. As well as finding out more about Paul's fascinating work, we're going to be hearing a paper that he presented at the 2024 Undiscovered C.S. Lewis Conference, which was held at George Fox University. And the title of Paul's paper there was On Fernseed, Elephants, Boltman and Lewis, Varied Expertise in Critical Perspective. Paul, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Ruth. Great being with you.
I feel like we've got so much to dive into there, Paul. You're clearly an expert in so many different areas. But before we delve into some of your expertise, would you just say a little bit about how you first encountered C.S. Lewis?
Yeah, thank you, Ruth. Well, I first read C.S. Lewis in college. His Mere Christianity, I think, is a classic, a really a popular defense of the Christian and Jewish traditions. There really is a God. Where did the world come from? Are you arguing that it came from nothing? Go ahead and argue that. But there's order in the cosmos. And so where did that come from? Well, that, of course, goes back to the Greek philosophers and Heraclitus and others. And that's also where the New Testament was built upon within that Greco-Roman context. I also really loved his books, Problem of Pain and Miracles. Really liked his essay on the Inner Ring, which explains why some people's, I suppose, agendas are full. It's not that they're rejecting you, thank you very much, but that they have their own family and friends that they're working at. So when Jason Lapoyarvi was saying, hey, we're going to do a C.S. Lewis conference, I said, great. Did C.S. Lewis do anything on the Bible? And he pointed me to this essay on elephants and fern seed, which I read. And I said, hey, I could do a paper on that. And so Jason connected me with the C.S. Lewis Society of Oxford. They invited me to go ahead and present there on my UK lecture tour. And then I presented that same paper at George Fox.
Brilliant. Well, and we're going to hear that paper later and we're going to delve into that essay a little bit more because it might well be one that people haven't really heard of. As you say, people don't necessarily think of Lewis talking about biblical scholarship in this way. But just going back to the impact of Lewis on your own life, do you feel like any of his works, obviously you enjoyed reading them, but have any of them played a particularly significant role in your life or perhaps in your faith journey at all, Paul?
Yes, especially Mere Christianity, where he really argues rationally against skeptics, and many of their views are irrational. My own mentor at Earlham School of Religion was Elton Trueblood, and his book, A Place to Stand, which is one of those books I've gotten back into print, actually was a quarter century later sequel to C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. And so Lewis and Trueblood, I think, were really philosophical defenders of God being real and Christianity following on that premise.
And you've pastored various people as a youth pastor and as a pastor of a church. Have you seen Lewis impact anyone else's life, would you say?
Yes, and I think that especially his Narnia series has been really formative. My wife and I would read these to our children. They've come out in film and that kind of thing. And also kind of, you know, tagging on to mythic themes in scripture, but also building, I think, a modern biblical mythology, if I can say it that way, which kind of speaks to the transcendent issues in biblically formative ways.
And Paul, you mentioned so many of his works when you were talking about how you first encountered Lewis. Is it possible to pick out a favourite work of Lewis, a favourite book, a favourite quotation, or is that like asking you to pick a favourite child?
I'll quote our president at George Fox, Robin Baker, who is also a C.S. Lewis fan, really is a C.S. Lewis scholar, and he has an entire set of first edition Lewis books. He said, you know, like the sun, God or Christ helps me see reality. I'm paraphrasing that wrongly, but by the light of Christ, we see the world as well as seeing ourselves. And so as a Gospel of John scholar, where the light of Christ is accessible to everyone, at least potentially, it doesn't mean they're going to get it right. doesn't mean they're going to walk in the light. Sometimes people prefer darkness or shadows, as Plato would say, rather than the liberating power of truth and light. But that's really powerful. And I think it's a good place to be in assuming that people around us also have access to the light.
And do you feel like reading Lewis has in any way changed your perspective or perhaps particularly illuminated your perspective on a particular issue or area?
Well, as I said earlier, maybe his particular contribution that I think has influenced me the most, but not just myself, is his intellectual critique of atheism. That sometimes, if I can put it in my own words, sometimes a non-theist will challenge a shallow view of God and say, therefore, God is not. Well, have they really read Aquinas? have they read Karl Barth? Have they even read Rudolf Bultmann and his existential approach? Have they read C.S. Lewis? And so often people will throw away a doctrine that is worthy of critique, but that doesn't mean that all views are equally flawed. Have they read Paul Tillich, for instance? If they have read Paul Tillich, don't say you're an atheist. You haven't really considered the ground and source of our being. And with Elton Trueblood, if one is going to argue that being came from non-being, go ahead and argue it, but it doesn't fit with reality. It's like something came from nothing as magic, as opposed to something coming from something greater than itself, God, who is the source of personhood.
Paul, before we delve into Lewis's views on the Bible, on modern critical scholarship and the Gospel of John, would you share a brief summary of some of your work in this area? Because obviously you're a biblical scholar, a Johannine scholar.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much. As you can tell by my accent, I'm a Glasgow man. I bet. Did my PhD at University of Glasgow in the late 80s under John Riches, a great Anglican New Testament scholar. And really what intrigued me about the Gospel of John was the humanity and divinity of Jesus and the Son's relation to the Father, equal but subordinate, a high view of miracles but existentialized miracles. So as I got into John's theology, what interested me most was the epistemological origins of John's theological tensions. And so as I read all the great commentaries, and especially Rudolf Bultmann, now Bultmann argued that the source of the tensions was different theological sources or different sources with different theological views. And John Riches, my doctor father, he was one of Bultmann's translators. And so he encouraged me to work on Bultmann, also to go to Germany. So I went to Tübingen and studied with Otto Betz and Martin Hengel the summer of 1987. And there I analyzed the literary, theological, contextual evidence for alien sources underlying the Gospel of John and overlaying them, looking at John 6 as a case study. What I did, Ruth, was to take all of Bultmann's evidence for literary sources throughout his entire commentary and applied it out in John 6. There we should have evidence for a miracle source, a signs gospel, a Jewish, and then Gnostic revelation sayings, I am the bread of life, and then the evangelist's work, which he thinks became disordered, and then he reordered it, and you get Gnostic poetry when he reorders it. Rather suspect as an approach. And then, of course, the redactor must have added, eat my flesh and drink my blood, because the evangelist was anti-sacramentalist. Well, as I looked into all of the evidence for these sources, and this content is published in my book, The Christology of the Fourth Gospel, the distribution was random. And so with C.S. Lewis, there's no evidence for alien sources underlying the Gospel of John. I think we have a narrative, but with Bultmann, it's not dependent on Mark or Matthew or Luke. I think we have an independent memory of Jesus that develops in its own paraphrastic way, which is theologically, you know, developed, but that doesn't mean that it's not historical. And so looking at the epistemological origins of John's theological tensions, I've sided with C.K. Barrett that we have a dialectical thinker who thinks in both and kinds of ways, so humanity and divinity. I think that's also pushing back against some of the audiences in the Johannine situation and wanting to be apologetic. Jesus really is great and divine and does miracles. But then it's existentialized. Blessed are those who have not seen and also believe. And so you have engaging the audience. And then I think we have a prophet like Moses agency schema, Deuteronomy 18. The one who is sent is just like the sender, because he only does what the sender tells him to do and say. So that's Jewish agency schema. And so the father-son relationship is flip sides of the same coin. Jesus is one with the Father because he's totally subordinate to the Father, and his word comes true. Therefore, he really is the one that Moses prophesied. Again, that agency schema is not Gnostic. It's Jewish, okay? And then we have a literary construction drawing audiences into an imaginary dialogue with Jesus. So those are the four epistemological origins of John's theological tensions. And I think that if we understood those in their first century context, that would also help us appreciate how Christian theology developed and even Trinitarian theology. I mean, the author of John is not Trinitarian, but you can see how those themes developed then into later constructs.
That's really helpful, Paul. Just for someone who isn't aware of what epistemological origins mean, would you just define that term for us?
Yeah. So epistemology is the origin of an idea. And so, you know, as scholars in the modern era develop confidence in a methodology, and this will relate to the Lewis essay, like, oh, yeah, they had mythologies back in the first century. Oh, therefore, everything must be mythological. Well, is it? Or is it memory that might be developed rhetorically, you see? And so when people develop like source analysis or editor analysis, we'll call it redaction analysis. Oh, yeah, because Matthew and Luke used Mark as a source, and they are adding their material as redactors or editors with new content. Oh, therefore, let's explain how John developed by saying John must have used alien sources, not Johannine, or that an editor might have come along and added different material. Now, I do think that the Gospel of John was finalized after the death of the beloved disciple by somebody else, probably John the Elder, who finalizes, who writes the epistles. So I think we have an evangelist and a final editor. But against Bultmann, agreeing with Raymond Brown, I think that the final editor is more conservative. He's adding material that the evangelist had been preaching in a harmonious way. And I don't think eat my flesh and drink my blood is saying you must take the Eucharist or you have no salvation. If that's really what it is saying, then Bultmann's point is a good one, because Jesus in John is the way, the truth, and the life, as opposed to you have to do a ritual. But as I looked into that, the content is not saying do a ritual or you have no salvation. The content is if you're not willing to suffer with Jesus, and the bread that he gives us, the nourishment, is his death on the cross, don't expect to be raised up in the afterlife. So it really is costly discipleship, which is not alien to the evangelist's thinking. Further, it's a lot like Mark 8, if you deny me before men, I deny you for my Father's in heaven. And so it's a similar theological idea, the way of the cross, but it's just in different language in Mark and in John.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
We're going to take a quick break now, but if you are enjoying today's show, please do consider rating it and leaving a review on your podcast platform so that other people can discover it too.
Have you ever wondered if angel stories are real or just religious folklore? This month, Premier Insight is offering a fascinating ebook called The Case for Angels: Evidence, Encounters, and Scripture. It examines real-life testimonies, biblical insight, and reasoned arguments for the reality of angels today. If you're curious about the supernatural or how to talk about it with skeptics, this resource is for you. It's yours today as a thank you for your gift to Premier Insight. Get your copy now at premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis. That's premierinsight.org/C.S. Lewis to receive your ebook today. Thank you.
The C.S. Lewis Podcast with Alistair McGrath.
Welcome back to the show. We would love to hear your thoughts and ideas. Do get in touch on social media at Premier Unbelievable. Now let's return to the conversation. I want to hear more about Bultmann and particularly what Lewis thought of Bultmann. But before we do that, I guess pulling back to the sort of big picture, do we know how Lewis viewed the Bible?
Well, thanks, Ruth. Lewis, and I think he would say this also, was not a Bible scholar. Mm. He was a Bible reader, and he was a literary scholar. And so he's adding his expertise to how we think about the Bible. He also, and in relation to, I think this is maybe his main essay that he wrote on as a criticism of critical Bible scholarship, really isn't engaging biblical scholars directly. It's more he's engaging what people are saying about biblical scholars. And so Bultmann, in that sense, has heard what people are saying about biblical scholars or like historical Jesus scholars, like nothing here is historical. Nothing in the Gospel of John is historical because it's so theological. And so he's just pushing back against those general suppositions. And that's what he was doing in his 1959 essay there at Westcott College in Cambridge.
Brilliant. You said Bultmann there. I think you mean C.S. Lewis was responding to what people said. No, that's fine. That's fine. I'm just clarifying.
Yes, responding to those people, yeah.
Great. And given Lewis's literary background, as you say, he wasn't a biblical scholar. Do you think his approach to reading and interpreting the Bible differs significantly from a Bible scholar, from the way that a Bible scholar would approach the Bible?
Well, if I can be critical of Lewis, he's also outside of his expertise. Mm-hmm. I mean, he really has not read two centuries of German and British and American French critical scholarship. In that sense, I mean, he acknowledges he is not an expert in that field. Then again, he is a literary scholar. And so if someone's going to claim that something is fiction, or we know more about this than the original audiences did, then I think he's on solid ground to critique ways that scholars are overturning the past by a new and brilliant theory. Mm-hmm. Beware, it might be overturned by the next doctoral dissertation. Because that's what scholars do. We advance by critiquing one another. And in that sense, Lewis really is engaging from the outside. But as a New Testament scholar, I find myself agreeing with some of his points.
Paul, you may not know the answer to this, but in your reading of Lewis, because I'm aware you're not a Lewis scholar, but in your reading of Lewis, have you seen him show a preference for a particular gospel or perhaps draw more heavily on one over another?
Well, I think that he really does love the Gospel of John, and that's one of the reasons that he wrote his essay on Fern, Seed, and Elephants, because he's critiquing, I think, British scholars' appropriations of Bultmann. But let me back up a little bit. I think he's critiquing also British scholars building on the 1924 work of B.H. Streeter. And so I presented a paper at the national meetings the last 2 years at Society of Biblical Literature conferences, you know, challenging Streeter. I think Streeter is strong on the synoptic hypothesis that Matthew and Luke used Mark. He also argued for Q, although my friend Mark Goodacre at Duke is saying, well, maybe what if Luke used Matthew, then we don't need Q. Or my friend Richard Bauckham, who is now in Cambridge, he said, yeah, but what if Matthew used Luke? And so there's movement to even challenge the Q hypothesis. Anyway, Streeter's work on the synoptics is pretty strong, but it's terribly weak, and I think it's an embarrassment to critical scholarship to assume that John the Apostle died early. When I looked up the basis for that, there's absolutely no evidence for that. And the ancient sources that are quoted both don't say that. They disagree with that. They say that John the Apostle, this is Philip of Sides, Sidetes, 5th century, George Hamartalos, 9th century. They don't say that John died at the same time as James. They said that they suffered martyrdom, were killed by the Jews, etc. But that's just celebrating the martyrology, the Syrian martyrology on a day in December. What they both say, though, is that John the Apostle died in Ephesus after Domitian, who died in 96. And so Streeter, on that basis, says that John the Apostle could not have written the Gospel of John. It's written by a mystic. It's in the genre of devotional literature, and there is nothing historical in the Gospel of John. So John got all of his evidence or all of his material from Mark and secondarily Luke. And so we can like John for theology, but John is no good for history, so just kick it out. Now, Bultmann would disagree with that to some degree, because Bultmann thought that John is not dependent on Mark or the synoptics. But Bultmann had to come up with another theory, which is, again, on the same basis, John cannot have been written by an eyewitness, therefore John must have used different sources. So Bultmann also builds upon that fallacy. It's 1888, Karl de Boer, on the early death of John, which is totally bogus and an embarrassment to critical scholarship.
What do you think Lewis would have made of your work that you've been doing around John, and particularly around the fourth quest for the historical Jesus?
I think Lewis would really have liked what I'm doing. I'm not doing it trying to be conservative or traditional. In some ways, if we say John's historical or offers historical material, that's going to be a problem for Matthew, Mark, and Luke. What if John is right and the three synoptics are wrong on chronology? Okay, the temple incident happened early, not at the end. Now, I don't think it happened twice, but what if Mark, in gathering Peter's material, what if he just stacked it all at the end? So maybe Mark's is a general chronology instead of a knowing chronology. So I think Lewis would have liked the scientific way that I'm going about looking at how John's memory of Jesus developed in its own, you know, idiosyncratic ways. Just because it's theological, it doesn't mean it's not historical.
Thank you for listening to the C.S. Lewis podcast with me, Ruth Jackson. Many of the topics that we've touched on today are discussed in greater detail on earlier episodes of the programme. Check out our archive of past shows at premierunbelievable.com, where you can also find lots of great articles, videos, and podcasts. Plus, if you register on our website or sign up for our newsletter there, then you will get exclusive access to new content, free resources, and more. That's premierunbelievable.com. What did you think of today's show? Are there any topics or works of C.S. Lewis that you would like us to explore next? We would love to hear from you. Send us an email, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Connect with us on X, formerly known as Twitter, @premierunbelievablefe, or drop us a direct message on Instagram or Facebook at Premier Unbelievable. We have also recently launched on TikTok, so if that's your thing, or you know anyone else who might be interested, then you can find us there at premier.unbelievable. Your feedback and thoughts are so important to us, so please get in touch. If you're enjoying the C.S. Lewis podcast, please do consider rating and reviewing it on whatever platform you're listening on, as it helps more people to discover the show. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.